Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Ooh, what's up, everybody? After Things, here to please your need for After Things.
Brian Brushwood.
I'm more a fan of Things After, which are things that occur after things.
And joining me here in Peter Wax's studio is the Peter Wax, who is going to help us talk to author Stephen Merlino.
That's me. Hello. Hello.
First question.
What was that?
How do we pronounce your name, sir? Did I get it right?
Oh, Stephen Merlino.
Merlino. As I almost said, yes. That's Merlin. Oh.
It turns out in Italian, that's what they call Merlin.
they call him Merlin O?
Well, you got the pronunciation almost spot on,
I would say. I believe it. So, real quick, Stephen, when you find yourself in an elevator at, let's assume, a science fiction convention or something, what is the short pitch that you give about your body of work?
Well, what I've written is a story of a young man who must break a curse put on his fate or die on his 19th birthday. And the story starts with about 12 hours on the clock.
Oh, wow.
Nice. So there is certainly a narrative tension time wise. Is it all in that space, or do we spend time in flashback or setting up how we got there?
Flashback. We do. He has to deal with it, and I don't want to spoil anything, but he doesn't die in the first 12 hours. I'll tell you that. He manages to find a way with the help. To really to break it, the next sentence in the elevator pitch is to break the curse. He'll need the help of an immortal, the sword of a maiden, and a forbidden magic that might cost him the only woman he's ever loved.
All
so
right.
He kind of rolls the dice and gets help and manages to live long enough to possibly break the curse.
To possibly make a franchise that'll become a movie someday!
This book, by the way, is called The Jack of Souls, a new Rogan Knight epic fantasy series. So the Jack of Souls is the title of this book, I believe, we're talking about here.
By the way, this is what always happens is, of course, Andrew's very plugged into the author community, and he brings wonderful people like you here, and I find myself, like, after the fact being like, and it's now bought on Audible, so I'll be a huge fan within a week. But thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Well, it's great to be here.
Now, Stephen, you won a contest recently, some little things.
Oh, yes.
There.
The other thing, I wrote a story for the Writers of the Future contest, and that was also called The Jack of Souls. It's set in the same universe, kind of functions as a prequel chapter that goes back a little bit into the backstory. And I won a spot in Writers of the Future. This is the new Writers of the Future. Just came out in April. How do I get it to show up there? Can you see that? Great, great collection of stories in here. I met a bunch of people over the week, including Peter, and just had a great time listening to people like Orson Scott Card and David Farland and Tim Powers basically teach us about writing and talk to us about the business and have a big party down there. It's an amazing con. It results in this every year, this anthology, which this is the 32nd volume. The first one, I think, was 1982 or 83.
For you, what got you, when did you decide to become a writer? You know, when did you decide you were going to take the time out of what else you were doing and what you're working on, whatever, to try to put the energy into writing?
Well, I started writing. I wanted to tell stories as soon as I read stories. As soon as I read Lord of the Rings, for instance, I didn't get serious about it until after college. And then I got lucky. I got a job that would fly me away for a month, and I would work hard for a month, and then I'd have a month off. And so I put my head down and wrote for that month off, and kind of learned the craft. wasn't a quick road. You know, you got to put in the 10,000 hours, as they say. And but when did I really make the switch from just hobby writing to putting my head down? I guess that would have been somewhere in the 90s.
I think it's interesting that you call it hobby writing, because obviously you're putting in the effort and you're creating stuff. What was the moment that you realized you had made the transition from being a hobby writer, as you put it, to being a quote unquote professional?
You know, I probably misspoke a little bit when I said hobby writer, because writing was important to me even when I wasn't thinking about trying to get published. So I guess the switch, so professional writing, trying to get published, working towards publication, I wanted to share the stories. I didn't just want to be with my friends and my brother, you know, who would read anything I wrote. And so I just wanted to be part of that world with other people that also love to invent and imagine. And I just, it's more than just something you do for your own amusement when it becomes something you do because you have to. You can't not write, because you just don't feel good if you're not getting regular doses of writing. Makes it sound like an addiction, but, it's more of a meditation. You know, some people go to church every Sunday. I need to go write. Sunday. But.
No, I could definitely understand. It's that moment that you have something that's in you that needs to get out.
Talking about the movie Aliens or writing?
Yeah, all of the above.
Sometimes it's that painful.
Yeah,
you know, and that's something that we've talked about a lot on this show in terms of productivity and creative productivity specifically is conquering that line of understanding A, what is worth setting up a system for, and B, how do you conquer that idea of like, well, this is frivolous. I should not be spending my time doing this creative pursuit. And instead, if I have the strength and capability to set up a system, I should be doing it for something that is more conventional to make money.
You know, it's an interesting thing when you talk to people who, there are people who want to write and there are people who write. And I kind of sort of categorize that. And I think the difference is that my writer friends write. You know, we're not always writing in the direction we want to. We don't always know what we should be, but we're always writing. And when I talk to people who want to write, it's that it's sort of, I don't know that it's a different language they speak, but it is this very interesting, like, I want to write. I like to write. It's like, well, then.
Well, there's people there's people who talk about writing, and then there's people who are too busy writing to talk about writing.
Or us who write and talk about writing. But,
right, right.
Sure.
But that's things like, you know, Steven, to your point, you know, you just write. And I think that's the. And not to say that if you're not writing right now in some way that you can't become a writer, but you sort of have to realize that there is certainly things you can learn to make sure that what you write turns into books. There's certainly ways to learn how to focus what you're doing in that energy. But mm-hmm. if you really don't want to write, then you probably won't write. If you want the things that come with writing, a lot of people are like, I want to be a writer. Like, well, you know, like, yeah, how, you know, I need a co-writer. Like, well, then you don't want to write. You want the credit for writing, or you want your name on a book. You don't
want to
write. I remember when I was writing, the first thing I wrote was a middle grade novel that was a fantasy. And I was sitting at a bar with an actor named Brian Thompson. He used to work at the Seattle Rep. I told him about it. And I think I told him that I was trying to make it like a Roald Dahl or something. And he said to me, no, if you're going to be a writer, you need to write what's you, don't imitate some other dude. Find something in you that you want to tell and tell it the way you want to tell it. Don't look at somebody else.
I recently had the experience, Stephen, of going back and finding an article that inspired me 20 plus years ago. Penn and Teller, and I think we've talked about this on the show. The memory I had was that Penn and or Teller wrote an article in Genie magazine 20 something years ago, saying, "Let hate, not love, be your guiding force." Because if love is your guiding force, especially if you know, like for me, I loved Penn and Teller. I wanted to be Penn and Teller, and essentially the takeaway I got was like, don't try to be Penn and Teller, because the best you'll be is a pale imitation of a niche that's already filled. Instead, write down a list of everything you hate about every other magic act you've ever seen. Explain why they suck, why they're wrong, why they made you mad, and then just be the opposite of that. And now you've created something completely new and original. And that truly is your voice, and it truly is the mark that you have to leave on the art.
Oh, that's great. Well, there's a wonderful book, a fantasy book. I think it was written by Diana Wynne Jones, and it's called The Rough Guide to Fantasyland. And what it does is it makes fun of all of the overdone stuff in fantasy. And so it's kind of like your list of things that you hate about other people's acts. It's kinder than that, but it's hilarious. It makes fun of every sort of default setting in fantasy that's ever been done. And it's a good way to inspire, you know, new ways of thinking of things, because it points out the ways that have all been done.
I think it's a very, very interesting approach in that the idea is, I certainly think there's something to say that I'm not, but I know a lot of magicians said, I'm not this, and they came up with horrible acts because it was all about everything they hated. But you have that balance between what you don't like about it, but then what you love. And you find, like, well, I love this. I aspire. And you watch Penn and Teller's show, and it's filled with things that they love, things that they're enamored with outside of magic.
Sure.
Sometimes deep in the history of magic. And I think that it's – I've read stuff that's so reactionary that it's clearly defined by everything else. Well, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to make that choice. And it's like indie films. Well, my character's going to die at the end because they live at the end. Well, that's another cliche.
Well, you were talking about having energy versus passion a couple nights ago.
From Scott Adams' book, yeah.
Right, and that's I think, what you're keying into. What we're talking about is you have to have energy for something, not just passion for it, because passion talks, but energy walks.
And I think, really, to me, the language that is spoken by creators that is foreign to folks who are either at the beginning of their journey or have not gotten into it and won't get into it because they don't want to learn this language is just like what it feels like to face yourself every day and find something to create, right? Like that is a different journey. And even understanding simple things like, hey, I hate this. Now let me build something because of my criticism of it. Or I love this. Let me build something because of my criticism of that is totally different once you are actually making something and not just in your head thinking about, like, oh, okay, well, in my version of it, it wouldn't have had this, or it wouldn't have done this, or it definitely would accentuate these elements. Like, writing is such a writing specifically, especially novel writing, because it's such a longer form art, is so introspective. And I think that's something that you... I've certainly enjoyed watching, you know, Andrew and other people that we've known, their journey through it because of that. You know, because you have to really, really, really deconstruct. If you hate something, it can only be beneficial to you if you deconstruct that thing that you don't like and find out exactly why that bothers you, right? And very often the roots of that, the things that you want to change, are far beyond the surface. You know, they are mechanical elements that you only really think about if you put the time and effort to thinking about form and function.
Mm. You know, you mentioned that novels are long form, and I'm going to be curious, Stephen, what your process is, but they don't necessarily have to be as long form as you think they are. You've got people like Philip K. Dick, who the legend is, and I do not know if this is true or not, but this is the legend from multiple sources. He would get an 8-ball and just go for multiple days straight and finish a book. To people who do take a year to 2 years, it's a vastly different process for everybody. And Stephen, I'm curious, how long does it take you to work out a book to really get through that process?
It takes me quite a long time. It was interesting down at the Writers of the Future workshop where I met you, Peter. One of the things I found interesting was the two lead teachers, David Farland and Tim Powers, were very different in that respect. Tim Powers takes about 3 years to write a book, and he says that's the only way you can do it. And David was talking about, you know, getting two out a year. And so I find that very fascinating. because I'm closer to Tim's style of writing or process, although I'm trying very hard to speed that up. I'm trying to make it a year. With your first novel, you know, with my first novel, I had a lot of time to, you know, no one had a stopwatch on me. I was trying to learn the craft and get it going and putting it through contests and literary competitions and so on and refining it. And for the second one, though, which I'm working on now, I had hoped to get it out in 6 months, but it's going to be a year. So it looks like a year is probably my comfortable zone, as long as I still have the day job and, you know, raising a family and everything.
Tim Powers is interesting because he sold one of his books to the biggest franchise on the planet.
By the way, I really wish everybody had video of this moment right now, at which point Andrew hands over, you know, sold it to, and then did not get picked up. So to who?
Pirates of the Caribbean. They bought one of his books to become on Strange Tides. And so he'd written a book that was a pirate-themed story, and then they looking for a title or something they could use for a Pirates of the Caribbean. So it became like was the fourth Pirates of the Caribbean movie was On Strange Tides, came from a Tim Powers book. So there might be something to the picking 2 or 3 years to, you know, finish a book if you're going to get, you know, a big payout from.
Right. And he did help found, you know, some little subgenre, steampunk.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I see writers talk about this online. You know, there's people who talk about cranking them out, takes 3 months to get a draft out and then 3 more months to get it to market. And those people can make a lot of money doing that. But I cannot conceive of a way to do that. I could, I guess, but it would not be very. I can't find a way to create a layered story that way. Maybe, you know, we did learn some interesting techniques down at Writers of the Future. For instance, one of the things was go ahead and make a list of, for instance, you approach a scene and one of the ways you can start it is to ask the question, what is the worst thing that can happen in this scene for this character? Because you're basically your job as a writer when you're telling a story is to make things bad. A series of crappy things happen to the main character, so they have to work to get out of it. And that's how they display who they are and their resourcefulness and so forth. And he was saying, go ahead and think that and make a list, but pretty much cross out the first couple things you come up with, because you're just getting warmed up on those. Go to your third idea, your fourth idea, and that's where the real meat is. And in the past, as a writer, I suppose I probably just went with my first idea all the time. And then what would happen is in revision, I would have to turn up the volume on that, because it really wasn't quite as awesome as maybe as it would have been if I'd thought just a couple more ideas past that. And so by starting, you know, if I can learn the technique of going to the third idea always, then it'll reduce the amount of time that I have to take in revision to make it, you know, amp it up to number 11.
It's, you know, it's a very interesting approach towards that. And it gets into, you know, having the thing that was for me, the point at which I understood story, at least that helped me, was just the idea of story is conflict. Story is conflict. It's, you understand it through the conflict. It's not world building. It's not one creating this wonderful character sheet. It's the conflict and getting into those conflicts and choosing the ones that are going to be the best to define the characters you just said. And that was, for me, so helpful.
Yeah. I hope I can write faster by employing that technique. Because I do want to write faster. I'm not at all wedded to the idea of being some kind of, you know, time intensive craftsman. I'd rather be a really efficient craftsman.
I'm with you. I believe that. When I write my outlines, everything, I start with what is the big conflict of the story, and each chapter is what's the conflict, and that's how it moves forward. And then I figure out meta conflicts for acts, and, you know, you can argue on whether or not, you know, act structure is real or needs to be or whatever. But I certainly think that the conflict motivated storytelling is a way to know where it's going to go and be able to figure out how it's supposed to end.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So you talked about exercises and things that Dave and Tim were teaching you. What were some of the exercises you did some of the other ones, because I know what some of the classes are, and they're super mm-hmm. cool.
Well, one of the most valuable things was the one day, the 24-hour story. And I remember as a kid watching this, after school special thing with Ray Bradbury, and he was sitting at a desk, and he had all these knickknacks on his desk, and he said, you know what I do when I start a story is I just grab a couple random objects like this, and he picks a little tin soldier up, and this a little box, and this thing a coin. And he goes, and I make a story out of it. So for this, and he starts to put together a story out of these random pieces. And I remember as a kid looking at it and going, no, he doesn't. That's complete bull crap. And yet what they did for this exercise is they gave us each a random object. I ended up with a 38 special shell. Person next to me ended up with this lens with a copper ring around it from an old telescope, and just random stuff. And the idea was to take some kind of inspiration from that and to craft a story. And then the other thing we were supposed to do was go out and interview someone on the street and take some inspiration from that and somehow get the ghost of a story going. And so I did that. And then you had 24 hours to write a story and turn it in. And then we all kind of critiqued them. I wrote a story, and I've never done that before in one day. And it was fascinating because, at first I was stumped. I'm looking at this thing. I'm thinking, what the hell? I've got a 38 special shell, and I write fantasy. So am I going to write urban fantasy now, or, and then I worked around it, and then I got a spark. And then as soon as I got that spark, I knew who I wanted to interview. I went out and I found some street kids and got talking to them, and man, it was really a good experience. And then I sat down and wrote, and I think that story is going to be a damn good one when I get a chance to work on the second draft. I got to finish a novel first, but that was one of the exercises, and it was really a key one, because one of the things it taught me was that it gave me a chance to practice that going to the third idea thing, because you got to be efficient with it. And the other thing is I've never actually written a story in one sitting before. So that was, I now know I can, which was a pretty cool experience.
It's one of the things that we need to think about in writing, like any other skill, is you got to have your ways of pushing yourself. I'll sit down to the list and say, I'm going to put together 20 ideas, 20 things and whatever. And you first three are hard, the next five gets harder, and then you get to maybe 8 or 9. It's a challenge. And then all of a sudden you start filling in those blanks. If you don't do it, you don't know. And writing something in 24 hours, you're taking decisions that you may have spent weeks on and condensing that. And sometimes you find that solving one problem gives you the answer to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
I love those kinds of activities. One of our friends, do a little shout out for Brett Runceville with his Mission Pick. Mm-hmm. And he's got an app for photographers. And every day it's a new challenge. And so the idea is, as a photographer, go photograph this, go photograph something like that. And what's really helpful, gosh, Bryce is so fast with getting the graphics up. It's amazing. Wow. And it's a great way, if you're visually oriented, and to try to think about things in a different way. If you say, our topic is going to be birds, or it's going to be something along these lines, you're going to go, let me not just think of the most obvious way that I would do it. And to your point, what's the third thing that comes to mind? What's the other option? And that's when it becomes novel and interesting, just as in writing and storytelling and not going in the obvious direction. Really great photography is something that's been in front of you all along and you didn't know it was there. The same with great storytelling. But yeah, check out Mission Pick by Brett Runceville. That'll be my pick for the show.
Cool.
There you go. There was a writing prompts version of that, but it was a Kickstarter deck of cards. I don't remember what it was called. Mm. Maybe it was called Writing Prompts. But it was basically a deck of cards, and it would be prompts. It would be like, you pull out a random card if you were stuck, and it would say, make your character leave the scene, or make somebody beat up your character, or, do all these random things. And it was just like, okay, I'm stuck. I'm going to find something that's going to push me through.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Conflict cards. That would be really useful. I always think of that. Yep. I can't remember.
So this is it right now. Writer emergency pack. It did fund on Kickstarter. It's a deck full of useful ideas to get your story back on track. It made 158
thousand. I would love to say $1 million. That would be amazing. But $158,000, right?
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting one.
Yeah, I supported that Kickstarter because I thought, I'm like, oh, this is, it's a neat idea. It's they've got some neat like graphics in there and all that. In my book on Cure for Writer's Block, I rail against writer's prompts. I have a personal problem is that when you have to start going to that direction, that I think that need to rethink your career. I'm kidding. But John August is a screenwriter, and so he wrote. He did the story for Dark Shadows. Did the screenplay for the recent. Did Corpse Bride. Did Frankenweenie. So he comes from a screenwriting background, and so I think that's when I read that. I'm like, when I looked at the thing, I'm like, yeah, this is as a novel writer, this is probably not the same direction I'd want to go to. But when you're trying to do film, problem in film is like, man, like it's a very, very. There's just a few templates that you're supposed to create from, and it's right. Much, much harder to go into a different direction without making it go really weird or whatever. But so John August Bynum is an extremely accomplished guy. Wrote Big Fish, several projects. Wow. So there you go. The writers.
Who was it? Who was the noir writer, the hardboiled detective writer? Chamber? No. Anyway, I can't remember who it was, but he said, when in doubt, have a man come in the room with a gun in his hand.
Yeah.
If there's ever a sag, if I feel a sag between chapters, I think of that, you know, basically. You got to find the conflict.
Room with a wand.
Something bad's got to happen.
Yeah. Raymond Chandler is the.
Raymond Chandler. Yeah.
So at this point of our show, we're going to do picks, and my pick's going to be the Jack of Souls audiobook.
I already bought it. I'm actually, to be honest, I just finished an audiobook today, and my pick will be the hour-and-a-half-long audiobook I used to fill the void. Derek Sievers is the guy who created CD Baby, and he has an extraordinary, very, very short book called Anything You Want, where he talks about the nature of creating that business and lessons he learned and things that in so many ways, Anything You Want is absolutely the blueprint that we use to create Scam Stuff. And we're doing our best to delight and surprise customers, and re-listening to it has been fantastic. It's great.
I like the Audible. Bryce pulled the Audible version.
Yeah, the Audible, as a matter of fact, I just heard part of the reason it went back on my radar is because the cover for the Audible version, it's just a kid buried up to his neck in sand with his eyes squinted, waiting for, the incoming tide to blast his face. Apparently, Derek Sievers didn't like that cover, but it was, why am I blanking on his name? He's the most famous motivational, it's Seth Godin. Yeah, anyway, it's really, really good. Anything You Want. It's great.
Hey, my pick for the creative professional is Shopify. I set up last week on this show, when we last left our heroes, Justin had set up a sticker website called Stickers or DIAF. Andrew went and bought a sticker and realized a few very key things. Number one, taking PayPal was not easy and was not listed. Number two, the email that got sent to him was not, didn't have key graphics, yada, yada, yada. I found it very easy to set up and switch to a Shopify store. What you see at Stickers or DIF now is totally made within Shopify. I just went out and took a few pictures and put it on there. It has been very easy. It is different than the other platforms in that you do have to pay for it. There is a very cheap monthly option where you can just get the online store. I wound up upgrading to the $18 a month thing. But I very much enjoyed it. It's been, there's a little bit of a learning curve on the back end. But for something that is, hopefully going to be a fairly set it and forget it kind of thing for me, where I can just, get new stickers, put them up on social media and sell them. This has eliminated a lot of the headache in terms of making a website and keeping everything set for me, as well as providing very easy visual graphics to understand where stuff is coming from. So check it out, Shopify.
I got into Shopify because of Brian's recommendation, and since I plugged in all of my ebooks and everything else into there, it is seamless. I forget it even exists, except when I get the billage month. It is, but it's good. It's really, really, and if you're setting up some sort of auto-fulfillment service too or whatever, it is a invisible platform in that way, and I've been very, very happy with it. I underuse it. I really, really underuse it. So, awesome. Thank you, Brian.
Sure. I'm the guy who discovered it.
You told me about it. It was you who told me about it.
No, sure. Yeah, no, it's I'm just being bashful is all. I'm glad you guys like it as much as I do. Tell me, do you guys have the app installed? The app is really, really good, and it's very tempting to leave the app running so that every time a new order comes in, you hear your pocket go cha-ching.
I had a thing with my books. There's a Kindle KDP. There's a plugin called Book Report. You go to getbookreport.com. And what it is if you're selling books on Amazon, you can run this in the KDP dashboard, and it gives it a much better looking interface so you can actually understand what your sales are.
Uh-huh.
And you can click in a cash register so every time somebody buys a book, ka-ching, which is kind of cool. And you get, like, you launch a book and you hear ka-ching, ka-ching, it's cool. And then when you don't hear it, you're like, oh. I'm not going to do anything until I hear. Oh, ka-ching. Oh, okay. All right.
The best moments are those strange moments when you know you're buying a frivolous, like, oh, I'm getting the extra grande double latte. I don't know. I kind of feel guilty. And then you hear cha-ching. You're like, well, I did just make $4. And
yeah.
Click, lock.
No, it is something that is, I think, hopefully very, continues to be a positive element in my life that, you know, I can just tweet about new stickers, and then all of a sudden it's just like cha-ching, 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 and I'm like, oh, look, I'm working. Look at me working about taking pictures and tweeting.
I noticed a cool thing about Book Report, which is not an undocumented feature, that is if you're using Safari and it's connected to the cloud, and if you leave Book Report running on a computer like my Mac back home, and then I go type in the URL for the Kindle KDP.amazon, it'll show me if I've left it running what my sales are so far in the history. It'll be like, oh, here. So it's pulling that data live through there. So kind of cool. They don't tell you can do this. I don't even know if the developer knows that it does this.
Right on.
Spectacular.
Thank you.
What other picks we got?
I'll take a pick just to piss off Andrew. I'm going to go with the Writer Emergency Kit. Sorry,
nice.
The Writer Emergency Pack.
Which I bought and supported.
You did. And I'm going to say, you know, young writers out there, if you find yourself stuck, don't worry. You don't need another career. You just need some practice. And this can be a great tool to help get you through those times.
And then get rid of the training reels. Okay. Get rid of the training wheels.
I've got a pick. If you're doing audiobooks, I've been listening to the Three Body Problem.
Ooh.
Which is mind-blowing Chinese science fiction. Really, really been wonderful. It's long, but it's excellent.
When it talks about the three-body problem, is it talking about the third gravitational body and how unpredictable it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It refers to a couple things. One of them, it refers to a game that people play. It's an online it's called a Vive game. Yeah, that's exactly what it refers to.
Right on. Can you tease us a little bit more, because I'm intrigued, but
yeah.
But
okay.
I did just blow my Audible credit on a book.
Well, it plays with the idea of the Voyager idea of sending Voyager out there and somebody answering it, except in this case it's not Voyager, it's a Chinese. The Chinese were worried that the only message going out into the universe was the capitalist message. So during their Cultural Revolution, they created this gigantic dish that could transmit a message much faster, you know, into the universe, much faster than the Voyager could. And you know, it was very, you know, it was very political and so forth, but it was a greeting to the universe. And then the premise is what someone gets it and receives it. And it's what happens after that. And it's
that was a good dodge. I was just like, okay, I'm engaged. Stop talking. It's only spoilers from here.
I want to say that it was a Sixton Lou's son who did the translation for it. I think I may be mistaken. That's one of these things too. Is whenever you do the translations on these, that there can be the you worry about how much gets lost because there's a lot of great.
Yeah.
Find out there's a lot of great science fiction written in other languages. Who knows? Who knew? Some French guy named Verne, you know, whatever.
Right.
I'm trying to see if that was who did the translation, but that was
Amazon says it was Ken Liu.
Yeah.
Right, which I think Andrew was saying, yeah.
I don't know if there's a relationship or not, but...
Man, I'll have to give that a try. The last translated science fiction story I read was 1Q84 that I loved the writing style of, but ultimately, like, it wasn't until after I finished it that I realized that was a lot of people waiting for other people to do something. that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Anyhow, yeah, I've heard great things about it. As Peter pointed out, won the Hugo Award, so it's a very celebrated novel. So, gentlemen, Stephen, thank you so much for coming on here. We really appreciate it. We look forward to digging into your books and hearing back from our listeners as they experience them.
And, oh, wonderful. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.